I had some quick notes here. We got up to my being a judge almost, didn't we?
I think we had gotten to Cook County Assessor's Office.
Oh, well, that's...
Public career, and we thought that'd be a good place to sort of resume.
When I became a public man. I'd come out of law school and I clerked at the DC Circuit. And then I worked for Bell Boyd for 5 years or something. I went into the state's attorney's office. Did we get into there?
You had talked a little bit about some of the, I think it was ICC cases in the state's attorney's office.
No, that was it. Oh, yeah, that's right. We had a litigation involving the valuation of railroads, and what I learned from my third year law school course in administrative law was useful at that point. And I stayed in that job until I found that I was could answer 85% of the questions came across my desk without having to get up, so I figured I wasn't learning anything new. And at that point, I left for the Chicago Federation of Settlements and Neighborhood Centers to help fight the war on poverty.
What's that? I'm not familiar with that organization.
It doesn't exist. So
That may be why.
It went out of existence. No, it was a grouping of a lot of settlement houses, neighborhood social service agencies all over the city. When the war on poverty came along, the city didn't want to deal with 40 different agencies and didn't want to have to police them as to how to keep their books and what sort of papers to submit. So they all flowed through the Federation office. I was hired as something like controller or associate director, and so that was my principal responsibility there, was to, figuring out the cash flow and the paper flow in a very substantial federally funded undertaking. It all passed through the city, so we were actually dealing with the city. And all sorts of programs, Head Start and things like that. I had been on the board of the Federation of Settlements before I left the state's attorney's office, and actually what precipitated my departure was the head of the director there said he needed help. Would I be interested? So I said yes. Because I'm always looking for new things to do. I used to tell people the reason I changed jobs every 5 years was that I was diagnosed with low board of the threshold. So I can't remember, and it was a very interesting experience. I had worked with a local settlement house in Kenwood, right next to Hyde Park, where I lived all that time. My first wife was a social worker, and I guess maybe my second wife was too. I can't remember. I think they both went to SSA, University of Chicago. Anyway, so that's the do-gooder side of me. My father was always definitely afraid that I would do something, would spend my life doing good rather than doing something significant or useful. Academics have their own standards. What's useful and what's worth doing. So then, I went from there into the assessor's office. And that came about because we had an assessor named Parky Cullerton at that time. And the chief deputy assessor was Tom Tully. Tom Tully was somebody I had trained for the job simply because Cullerton was looking for a new chief deputy, but he wasn't quite so overt. He just brought in this one of his precinct captains who had been a prosecutor on the west side in the criminal division of the state's attorney's office. And I was supposed to show him around all the various tax offices to explain how the system worked. I had no idea why I was doing that and whether he'd be around long enough to be of any use. But anyway, he was hired by the assessor. And then when there was a big near scandal in the assessor's office, they sort of cleaned out and put Tully in as chief deputy. Then he served for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and then maybe not that long. Cullerton's term was going to come to an end a year later, and he wanted to leave the office so he could run for the office. He didn't want to be running for the assessor's office as chief deputy for, I don't know why, but that was the situation. So he had to find somebody to take his place. Cullerton wouldn't let him go until he found a suitable replacement, he said. So Tully asked me, he asked his law partner, he said, who knows more about real estate taxes than anybody? So this other guy fingered me. So he offered me the job. And I don't know that he knew anything about my political involvements, but I came with good enough credentials through the ward organization. But I said to him right off the bat, well, there's one problem, Mr. Cullerton doesn't know who I am. Well, Tully was equal to the occasion. He lied and said, of course he does. He thinks very highly of you. I said, okay. And then he wanted to make it a big secret. He announced his own departure and didn't tell anybody. He and Cullerton didn't announce anybody to replace him until it got right up to the time he was about to depart. So there was wild speculation and a lot of interest in the office as to who was going to replace Tully.
And why would he do that? Why would he want us?
He liked drama.
Like the intrigue?
Yeah. And it was so out of left field, I think he got a real kick out of it. And the night before he was going to make the announcement, I woke up in a cold sweat and called Tully the first thing in the morning. And I said, Tom, I said, does Mr. Cullerton know I'm a Protestant? So he lied again and said, yes, no problem. We have a long line of Irish Catholic assessors in this county. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then I stepped into this job. I had a staff of 300 people. I'd never had an administrative job before. Mm-hmm. And I inherited a lot of his people, of course. And he had cleaned out the place after the big scandal and put in a lot of his friends and younger people, and he, anybody who wanted to go to law school, like, he would pay for if they could work for him. So there was a lot of budding law school aspirants in the office. And, you know, it was an exciting place to be. They put in the computerized system called multiple regression to figure out what the proper assessments of property were. So then Tully went across the street to his office and practiced law. assessment wrong and other things. But it wasn't quite clear. Some of his people would still go across the street to ask him what they ought to do instead of asking me. So it was a little iffy. But, you know, Tully and I got along fine. He was very much at pains to support and back me up at that point. So it was a learning experience, and you certainly get to know the ins and outs of the system.
And what were your primary areas of focus as chief deputy there?
Well, just finding out how the office was running and where the bottlenecks were, who was performing, who wasn't, just all the problems that you get with an administration. And the other problem was I knew more about the functioning of the office than most of the people who worked there. I worked in the state's attorney's office because I had to acquaint myself with it. Some of this litigation, I remember one memorable day, and I used to have staff meetings, which was considered novel. Every Tuesday morning or something, we would gather in my office and get reports from my department heads and find out who was doing what, and make assignments, set timelines, and that sort of thing. And one time somebody came with the problem, what is our policy on partial construction? If you put up a building during the year, how do you assess it as of the first of the year? And I said, well, what's been the practice? And I got several answers to that. And I said, well, you put your heads together to find out and come back and tell me next time. So they did, and it was depending on the date of completion, there would be a percentage assessment made. You know, a fairly rational system. I said, oh, okay, that's fine. Let's write it up and I'll for my signature. And they all blanched and said, what would you want to do that for? And I said, well, there's only two requirements to making a policy public, and one is you have to know what you're doing, and the other is you want to treat everybody the same. And they said, well, neither of those requirements have ever been met in this office. But so it was a lot of fun. And I don't think there was ever another memo that was ever signed by the chief deputy after that. But it's a historic document now. People wave it in the assessor's face even to this day. But a lot has changed since then. But anyway, personnel problems, which I wasn't used to. Mm-hmm. Going back to my Navy days, I never didn't have much success in managing people. But, there was a good spirit around the office. And Tully had sort of cleaned out the sources of independent entrepreneurship in the office, where various departments would collect fees on their own for doing their job. So that.
And was that the big scandal that happened?
Yeah, that was part of what was going on. But Tully was very vigorous, and that had been done before I got there, and the office had been pretty well professionalized, so it was just my job to make sure it didn't slip back. And the question arose what field men do. They're supposed to go out, every time a permit is issued by a municipality, they go out and inspect the site and draw up cards for our permanent records on that. So I asked at one of our staff meetings, well, what do they do? I said, have any of you ever gone with one of them? Well, nobody had ever done that. And I said, well, I want everybody in the next 6 months to pick one day that they go ride shotgun with one of the field men. So I did that on a couple of occasions, one of my chief assistant did, but as far as I know, we were the only two who ever did it. But you get to know what the field staff is doing, and they would level with you. And it was sort of amusing. I mean, you know, it's a culture all its own. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing venal about it, but in fact, I got to the point where I used to, there was a four of the field men who decided I need more education in how the system works, so they suggested we all go out and drink beer together sometime. And so we did that on a fairly regular basis, every 6 months or so. And they said there are only two rules. Well, two rules. You can't pay for anything, and nothing we say here is ever repeated. So you get a lot of good information that way. So that was my brush with public life. Well, I, of course, been in the state's attorney's office, but that was a different experience. I guess I mentioned last time about the when a new problem would arise, I would ask how my predecessor had handled it, and they said, oh, he didn't. So I have to make up a way of handling it. And I said, well, what did you guys do? He said, well, we just waited it out until you came. So there's a certain, you learn a lot about how people deal with bureaucracies. Partly they, you know, some of the old-time practitioners told me, you know, there's one person in every office that knows what's going on. And it's never the person you think it should be, but it's your job to identify who that person is and get on their good side. Then they'll tell you. And, you know, that's how government tends to function. I don't know if you want to dwell any more on that. You can ask questions about it later if you do. But anyway, then I, at one point, said to Tully in the, fall of 75, that I wanted to move on. I'd been there, I had only been there 2.5 years at that point. And I said, well, you know, my family is looking for a little more support than I can give them on this salary. And since I limited myself to my salary as far as income goes, which apparently was another novel point. He said, well, I understand, but I think what you should do next is become a judge. I said, oh? He said, you'd make a great judge. He said, you know, slating comes up in December, and Mr. Cullerton will certainly put in a good word for you before the slating committee, and if you'd like to be that. And, you know, I was planning to serve to the end of year in December. He said, well, why don't you wait and see if he gets you, succeeds in getting you slated. If he doesn't, well, then you can move on. And so I went before the slate making committee, and it was chaired by the chairman of the committee was one Richard J. Daley. He didn't really know who I was, but when I came and appeared before all the committee, he said, well, now, Theodore, tell us why you'd make a great judge. And I said, well, my first qualification is for 10 years I've been a precinct captain for Claude Holman in the 4th Ward. Standing ovation. You know.
And for him that was the most important qualification?
Well, it actually was a sort of an icebreaker. Everybody knew it was. And then they asked about my qualifications. And so they, in fact, slated me. I remembered at the last minute to make sure I went to Claude Holman and ask him, because Tully had arranged it with Cullerton, and I didn't want to. So I had it both ways, from my own committeeman, who was not unpowerful, and then Cullerton, who was probably the number two man in the party organization. And so I didn't have any trouble getting slated. And that year they created a whole lot of new judgeships. So they created 20 new judgeships. I can't remember. Anyway, there were a group of 10 that were running at large, in addition to the vacancies that normally get filled. On a vacancy, it's a head-to-head contest for that seat, whereas when they create new judgeships, they let them run at the top. There were 15 in the city, ran countywide, and 10 in the city. So there were 25 altogether. Well, everybody who was running against the machine thought, that's the best place to hit. So there were 60 candidates in the primary for those 15 spots. That is including 15 in the party nominee. And they were not at the top 15 on the ballot either. You had to count down 14 numbers before you hit the party slate, which was all together. So you were totally dependent on party discipline to get them. Anyway, the party did a remarkable job and carried 14 of the 15. It passed into the primary and got them past the primary. Then it was virtually no contest in the general election, although it was countywide. The Republicans still put up candidates back in those days.
And why had they created these new judgeships?
The expansion of the court that couldn't handle the business. You know, it's been a long time since they added judges.
Had you thought of being a judge before it was recommended to you?
I guess maybe I had thought about it. I always thought maybe I'd be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I didn't have any of the intervening steps laid out. And then the next question, after got through the primary, then went to the general election, of course, was in November, and I got sworn in December, and about that time it occurred to me what had happened, but Tully got a whole extra year out of me, because I had planned to quit the preceding December, so instead I stayed on until I got sworn in. Once I got past the primary, if I hadn't made it through the primary, I would have left then,
Did you actively participate in the campaign process?
Yeah, we had a group approach. We would we ran as a group, and it was coordinated, so we wouldn't inundate the ward meetings. That's where most people campaigned in those days. You go out and explain to the precinct captains that you're their buddy, and we'll look out for you and justice for the people and all this sort of thing, and I'm a hell of a guy besides, you know. One thing I failed to mention in all my campaigning was that I'd gone to Harvard Law School. I think that was on advice. With the augmenting of the court, there were, I think, 300 judges then, the total. There were, after I got elected and Bill Cousins got elected, that made a total of 3 from Harvard Law School. Bill Cousins, do you know Bill Cousins? Is that name there? He's a black guy that ran for, he ran against the machine on the city only slots. That's the first time anybody had ever done that. And he knocked off one of the party candidates and got slated. And then he was on the appellate court, I think. Or maybe not. Anyway, he recently ran for chief judge against Fitzgerald. He made a good showing, but didn't win. I don't know if he's still sitting there when he retired. Anyway, a really outstanding guy. And the other guy was somebody up who's in the northern suburbs, Lester Fink, who was, I think, an associate judge at that time. But anyway, I got myself elected somehow. And you learn a lot in campaigning. first thing Tony told me, never drive to one of these, because if somebody collides with you on your way home, they will insist that you were drunk, and there'll be a scandal. So I will always give you a driver, which was one of the staff people of the state's attorney's office. So one of my drivers, I was, it just shows the variegated nature of our party and our community. A guy named Riley McIntosh, who I had actually trained to be the railroad assessor in the assessor's office, and we became good friends. Still are, except I don't see him since he retired. And Riley McIntosh was my driver, and we went out to a ward committeeman whose name was Kelly. The interesting things about that is they're both black. And usually you think of Irish names as other than that. But anyway, it was, just a wonderful experience getting to know people all around the county. And not everybody appealed to you particularly. Some of the judges I campaigned with, some of them were sitting judges running for retention, and so, re-election, I can't remember. Anyway, for some reason I was campaigning with a judge I particularly didn't like, but he was decent to me and we were civil. He eventually ran for chief judge and I voted against him. And fortunately he didn't get elected. Well, after I got elected, then the question was, where will I be assigned? We have this totally integrated system. It's unique in the United States. It's the largest one in the United States, the totally integrated court system in the county. And any judge on any day can be assigned to any courtroom by the chief judge. And they don't do that. They tend to put you in an assignment and keep you there for a while. And sometimes they shift you and sometimes they let you stay. It depends on their requirements and your predilection. So I said to Tully, Tully asked me, what assignment do you want? And I said, I would like to renew my interest in the criminal law, since I didn't get into it in the state's attorney's office. When I told Dan Ward that's what I wanted to do, Tully said, okay, well, we'll get you there, but for heaven's sakes, don't tell the chief judge that, because if he knows you want it, he won't appoint you there. And where he appointed me was a place everybody else had asked for, but which was the tax section of the law division. I couldn't sit in the county division, which was then passing on everything I'd ever done in the assessor's office. I thought that would be inappropriate, although some judges couldn't understand what I was talking about at that point. So I didn't say anything, and he assigned me to the tax section of the law division. And unless you understand the finer points of jurisdiction, this probably doesn't mean much to you. But Tully said, you just go there and do what you're told. And the presiding judge was a guy I used to work with in the state's attorney's office, who I sort of trained in the field of clerks. Anyway, he was my boss. Tully said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll speak to Richard Fitzgerald. There was a Fitzgerald before Tom Fitzgerald, who had been presiding judge in the criminal division. And us old timers refer to him as Fitzgerald the Great, rather than the current Fitzgerald in the Supreme Court. I'm a dear friend of Tom's, but he's a different, he's a much more political creature than Richard was. Tully told me that what we'll do is we'll let you stay there about 6 weeks, and then Richard Fitzgerald will ask the chief judge for you. And that way it doesn't come from me. Richard Fitzgerald was thought highly by the high chief judge, because he was one of his real stars, really. And he was the chief judge, or presiding judge, kind of the Graylord investigation. Mm-hmm. He was the only judge the feds trusted with the information that this was going on. Mm-hmm. And so he was a highly respected guy, some of the national famous trial lawyers comment that he was the ablest judge they appeared before. Really, really remarkable guy. So, and Tully had been his prosecutor. That's how, the world moves around so that it positions itself to promote you somehow. So, my immediate boss was on vacation, and I had taken his calls in addition to my own in the law division, and the bailiff came in and said, "There's a phone call I think you want to take." I said, "Oh, it's the chief judge." I said, "Oh, court will be in recess." So I went and took the call, and Judge Boyle said to me, "Swain, this is Boyle." I said, "Oh, pleased to talk to you, Judge Boyle." And he said, "For some reason, Judge Fitzgerald is high on you." And I said, "Oh, I'm pleased to hear that." This was on a Friday afternoon. He said, "Monday, report to the criminal division." So I said, "Okay." So when my boss came back, I was gone. I mean, he came back the following Monday, mm-hmm. I left the fine drive. But when the question came up, I talked to him a little about, hypothetically, where I wanted to spend time, and I mentioned the criminal division. He said, "Oh, you wouldn't like that. That I was there 2 years and hated every minute of it." So I expected I would last about 2 years there. So I served out the rest of my time there, and never got tired of it. Never any two cases the same. Just kept learning and learning and learning. Of course, I had zero trial experience, certainly in criminal. I had litigated the railroad cases on the civil side, which I guess I told you what propelled me into fame was losing the largest civil judgment against the county up to that point. That bespoke the responsibility I carried rather than my... Actually, I felt very good about the way we conducted the case. But I didn't know anything about the rules of evidence since, I had a case in law school. It was the course I was most fuzzy about. What you ordinarily do is you have a trial call in the morning and you sort of process cases, find out what the status is. Where they are in discovery, when they're going to be ready for trial, and do they want a plea conference, and all that. And then sooner or later you get one that's actually going to a trial. There was one guy up on the floor above me who I knew pretty well, who had been in the state's attorney's office with me, and he was a very amusing guy. And so every time I had a sentencing, I'd say, how do you know how to sentence anybody? They had a program for us of a couple of weeks right after we started being judges, and that was very helpful, but it only goes so far. So I would go up and see him, and he would give me some good pointers. Of course, I'm not sure the omens were good. The first time I did that, coming back down, the elevator got stuck, so I called the you know, there's a phone in the elevator. I said, will you call my courtroom and tell them where I am? I haven't run away. And so I had to learn how to handle, you know, what my relationship was with the clerk, my courtroom clerk, and the bailiffs. You know, it's little noted, but there's seven different separate entities that all have to be present before court can start, and most of them, they're all independent of one another. There's the judge, who's elected, who's answerable to no one, you know, for the moment, except presumably the presiding judge, but then the prosecutor, who's appointed, assigned there by a separately elected state's attorney. There's the public defender, who's there by appointed by the public defender, who is selected, I think, by the county board. There's the courtroom clerk, who's an employee of the clerk of the circuit court, who's independently elected. There's the bailiffs, who are employees of the sheriff, who's independently elected. There's the court reporter, who's hired by independently by, again, by the county board. That's really the only commonality there. And then you need a defendant. When you get all seven of those together, you can start. I did learn one valuable piece of information. The judge is never late to court, because they never start without him. But I tried to make it a point always to be fairly timely. And there was a certain camaraderie between the prosecutors and the public defenders that were assigned to the courtroom. And they would always come into my chambers for coffee before the court started, just to make sure, you know, that everything was in order for the trial call. And then eventually I had my first jury trial. How do you pick a jury? In those days, you let the attorneys interrogate the jurors, and they would make their decisions. And one by one, the judges would tell me, you know, you're going to get tired of that, so eventually you take it away from them and do the questioning yourself. First place, you get much more relevant questions that way. And secondly, you're assured that the relevant questions do get asked, that the oversight of one of the attorneys doesn't work to the disadvantage of anybody in particular. And then again, here's managing a whole new population, array of jurors, which is a fascinating group of people. And one of the things that you get to appreciate is just how terribly seriously the jurors all take their job. Whenever I'd have a jury trial, I would always mentally make a note of how I would rule if it were a bench trial. And, you know, there were very few cases where I came to a different conclusion than they did. I'm not sure what their thought processes were. Some of them are very fascinating.
Other than sort of learning by doing and talking to other judges, were there other ways that you learned the ins and outs of the court?
Well, there was something called the National Judicial College. Well, the first year there was a program put on at Harvard, as a matter of fact, by another competing group that was not associated with the National Judicial College, which is located in Reno. And this other place had headquarters in Virginia, but they would sponsor programs. And this was for a course called Humanities and the Law. So it was, and I paid my own way to go to that, because they wouldn't pay your tuition and your expenses until you had served 2 years. Now, I thought that was mighty strange, because when you need it is the beginning. Mm-hmm. But at the end of 2 years, I went out to Reno then and understood what their thinking was, that I would have gotten virtually nothing out of the course if I'd gone right away. And you have to have confronted these problems before all this information means anything to you. And you learn how judges do it all over the country and the various judicial systems there are.
So how does this college work? Is it a couple weeks?
It's a 3 week residential course. They reserve a block of motel rooms, actually. They have a nice facility. The reason it's in Reno is because somebody gave them the money to build it there. And a guy named Fleischman, who you may know of because of his gin. So that's who founded the National or funded the National Judicial College. It's also the seat of the National Juvenile Court System. So some of my friends, I was coming out of the Fourth Ward, was a guy named Sylvester White, who was head of the juvenile court here for many years. He was noted for giving a speech out there once saying, he often reflected on the juvenile court system, and all he could think of was Charlie Brown and Peanuts after a game was over, and said opponents 99, home team 0. He was walking off the field with Lucy, and he was shaking his head. I can't understand it. We were so sincere. Sylvester White was likening the juvenile justice system to that, which always stuck in my mind. I never got close to juvenile court. My neighbor had suggested, who was head of the Commission on Youth Welfare when I first became a judge, insisted that I ask to be assigned to the juvenile court because that's where the need was the greatest. Well, I wasn't sure I could make much of a contribution there, and nobody even, that was not an option at the time, so I never did, but I've, you know, since gotten involved in a lot of activities in the Chicago Council on Urban Affairs, which I served on for many years, has got into a big study of the juvenile justice system. So I served 6 years, and then I ran for retention. Incidentally, when I ran in the first group, they always, of course, publish the election results. I came in 14th out of that 15. I didn't come in last, but the lady who came in last and actually bumped one of our guys off was right behind me. And the guy who got bumped was reslated the next time around. You know, certainly got his turn. So the second time around on retention, people saw the results and were shaking their heads. And it turns out I was near the top of the retention ballot, I mean, in terms of percentages. Of course, I assumed it was because I'd done a good job, but another guy named I can't remember his name now. A black judge with an Irish name, and I came in, you know, near the top of the list. And people would explain it, that people in the suburbs thought he was white and people in the ghetto thought I was black, because Swain is the name of this big chain of drugstores in Southside with that name on it. I guess I ran into it. The only people I've ever run into with my name have been black, mm-hmm. so I, you know, it's a name that's familiar to a lot of people, but you know, you just never know why people vote mm-hmm. for you. I got high ratings in all the bar polls, and so did a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. But, so that was, and then all during this time, toward the end of my 6-year term, my wife was increasing the pressure to get a decent job. You know, this you've been indulging this luxury too long. We're all paying for it, which translated into something like, you have 4 tuition-paying daughters, and the unspoken thing was, and you also have a high-maintenance wife. But we didn't talk about that part. So I had actually been interviewing as I was approaching the end of my term. I filed for retention, and just I didn't want to be without a out of a job. But then, so I went into a pool with the other guys who were running. Everybody running for retention pools their resources into a point, particularly on retention, trying to outdo anybody else. You just want, like the most recent election, everybody, all the retention judges got retained, which is not a bad idea in the sense that it approximates the federal system where you have lifetime tenure. In other words, you have to do something pretty bad mm-hmm. to attract newspaper attention. Unfortunately, the newspapers, or attention is attracted by the most irrelevant things, and they'll go after people just because they didn't like the ruling they made. Mm-hmm. Because newspapers have a way of trying cases before the court, before the trial starts, mm-hmm. and which is the bane of all judges. One of the things we learned in Reno is the one thing you cannot do is answer them. You cannot defend yourself. You just have to keep your mouth shut. And they had a lot of material that showed what happens when you do, because they control the newspaper, you don't. Or they can make you look stupid no matter what you say. So I had one case that the Sun-Times tried ahead of me. Mm-hmm. They were very unhappy with the result. But that's another experience that most judges encounter.
Were there other cases that were particularly noted publicly or important in that way?
There was a rape trial of a public defender, I remember, which achieved a lot of notoriety. And, it didn't occur to me I was supposed to handle this any differently than any other. And so they had pretty good counsel, veteran counsel representing the guy. But I found him guilty. That surprised an awful lot of people. I got a note slipped under my door from Judge Gillis, who was in the next chambers one afternoon after this ruling had come down. He said, congratulations on uncommon courage. I didn't realize I was being courageous. The learning process, a lot of things surprise you, and the learning process is one of them, and the places you get help. My first jury trial, I think I probably got in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most sidebar conferences. Every time one of the attorneys would make an objection, I would say, court will be in recess, attorneys will come into chambers. And I said, what's this all about? Educate me. And you have no idea the response you get. They were delighted that some judge finally was going to listen to their objection instead of just ruling off the top of his head and try to do it according to the law. You know, know. I thought they would hold me in low regard because I didn't know anything, but they were so glad I was willing to learn. And gradually you get the hang of it, and you talk to other judges. One thing that's, when we were at 13th Street, we started at 13th in Michigan until they got the new buildings built out at 26th Street. They built a big new administration building and moved everybody out, all the offices out of the courthouse, and made a lot of new courtrooms there, and so they brought the outlying criminal courts out there. One of the features of that facility was a judge's dining room, which, you know, doesn't exist downtown. And so, you know, judges could go out to lunch with one another if they wanted, and often would downtown, but there everybody ate at the same place. And it was depending on when your break was, when you took a break for lunch, depends on who was there at the time. So you, tables of 10, you'd sit down with whoever was there at the time. And so you really got to talk to other judges about how no judge, to my knowledge, ever walked into another judge's courtroom to see how he was doing. It just doesn't happen. I have a feeling that people would think they were snooping. Mm-hmm. And